Discussion, consideration, possible action regarding presentation information from representatives from the Psychological Clinical Science Accreditation System, PCSAS, on their proposed legislation for the upcoming session. So welcome to our guests. Could you please come forward and introduce yourselves?
Isolating me on the
sorry about that. This
and the floor is yours. Please introduce yourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Sabrina Vasquez. I am the Assistant Vice President for Government Affairs, State Relations with the University of Arizona.
Chairman, members of the board, I am Will Corbin. I am the Director of Clinical Training and Professor in Psychology at Arizona State University.
Chairman, members of the board, thank you for having us. I'm David Sabara from the University of Arizona. I'm a professor of psychology, and I was the director of our clinical program for 10 years.
Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate your time here. We wanted to come and present to the board. This is the second time we presented to you all on this issue. We're going to be pursuing legislation. So when I say we, I mean the University of Arizona and Arizona State University, as well as the Board of Regents, will be pursuing legislation this coming session that will add PCSAS,
Psychological Clinical Science Accreditation System.
I'm just the lobbyist. But we will be adding that to statute in order to create parity between that and the APA for students that graduate from either of those programs accredited by either of those entities will meet the list of requirements that are in statute to ensure that they have a program that like I said, meets the requirements listed in statute. We really just wanted to come and present, answer any questions that you have, and really hopefully work in tandem with you all on this legislation. But if not, we would at least appreciate an understanding of where the board would be on this bill. So I would like to open it up to questions or any comments moving forward.
Dr. Flower.
Yes, I have several. I certainly am not a complete expert on your program, but looking through the information on the website, there are a lot of things that were instructive. It does talk about how programs need to abide by relevant ethical codes, but it doesn't indicate that APA is one of those. So is that an oversight, or is it just left up to the institution whether they want to require that? How does that work?
Sure, I can start. I think that's pretty. I would say my understanding is that's probably implicit in the PCSAS guidelines. I mean, we're not talking about programs that are. Built in the garage. These are some of the strongest doctoral programs in the country with the best track record of training historically. And we may say, well, it is that case now, but in the future, will it always be that way? And in part, the answer is yes, because the graduate program itself, to be eligible for PCSAS accreditation, must hold the clinical science model, so has to hold in highest regard, aspirationally, has to have a coherent educational program outlined as part of the review for the review criteria. So although it's not stated explicitly, I would it's implicit.
Okay, I guess maybe another comment. It showed the kind of people on the faculty of the universities. The clinical scientist appears to be the model. It's like you want to have somebody as good researchers in clinical science rather than necessarily practitioners, even though part of the training involves, at least in their research area, to have some clinical expertise in that one area, whatever that might be. But I didn't see on the ideal faculty description any specification anybody needed to be licensed in practice of psychology. and that concerned me.
Dr. Flowers, so in terms of anybody providing clinical supervision, right, is going to have to be licensed to provide supervision for hours that are going to count toward licensure in this state or any other state. So while it's true that there would be faculty within clinical science programs who are not licensed, there would have to be enough faculty who are licensed to provide supervision, or supervision would have to take place from other licensed psychologists working in the community, which is really true of COA accredited programs as well. Certainly not all faculty in clinical psychology programs are licensed to practice, but all programs have enough faculty licensed to practice to provide the supervision.
Yeah, there definitely have to be some.
Yes, correct.
It's one. That's the COE requirement.
Yeah, I guess also I'm concerned about the lack of detail. It talks about there's a lot of flexibility the universities can have as far as what they want to do. And, you know, ACLA talks about, I think, practica and all those kind of things that are required. But flexibility, the concern to be that would maybe lead to some people being trained not to having the adequate training they need to be clinicians.
If I may, I think it's a reasonable concern, and there are safeguards in the system. So, for example, all graduates from PCSAS programs will do clinical internships. And so everyone coming forward to get licensed in Arizona is going to have the required clinical internship. When we back that up a little bit, APIC, the system that oversees the whole internship match, has recognized parity between COA and PCSAS, essentially saying if your students are coming from PCSAS only accredited programs, we understand that, and given CHIA's accreditation, the accreditor of the accreditor, CHIA's oversight of PCSAS, we recognize that these are high quality externship or practicum, depending on where you are, placement. So they are, the students in general are receiving high quality clinical training and placements along the way.
Then I guess another final question, it doesn't make sense. There will only be one final question, but another question that comes to mind, I looked at institutions need to be accredited by appropriate agencies. It's stated more delicately than that, but it doesn't necessarily, I wonder if it's the same accrediting agencies we already recommend or accept, or there are others that might be acceptable that we don't think are adequate.
There isn't. I think he's referring to the Regional Accrediting Association.
Yes.
And the universities actually require that. So we come under the umbrella of the regional, so it doesn't.
It would be included.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be an
included.
Issue. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions?
So just to confirm, I'm from the public, I'm a public member, represent the public. Just confirm, so the students that go through your program still have to meet all of our regulations, all of our rules in order to get their licensing. So they'd have to take the ECPP, potentially the part two, meet all the regulating criteria to.
Unless they have a program in Puerto Rico.
So, correct?
Correct. The part that provides parity is really around the curriculum, but they would still have to meet the predoctoral clinical hours. They would have to have a full-time clinical internship. They would have to pass the ECPP part two if and when that comes.
And it sounds like some of the students might more or less want to be researchers and not be clinicians. Is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, I mean, I think in response also to Dr. Flowers' point earlier, I think that the idea is not a great clinical scientist rather than a good clinician, but a great clinical scientist and a great clinician. And so they will have the flexibility to decide what kinds of careers they want to go into. Some of them will certainly still go into primarily clinical careers, but the kind of the hope, the focus of PCSAS is that they will continue to be actively involved in producing and disseminating science, but that could come in a lot of ways, including training the next generation of clinicians to use evidence-based practices, and that would be something that PCSAS would really value. They'd be doing that in their role as a clinician, but they'd be bringing the science to that. So,
okay. Thank you.
Are board members still on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
That was...
Mr. Diner is on the line.
Oh. Is Dr. Gill?
No, he
was Dr. Davies?
Dr. Davy indicated that at this time he would not be able to call back in.
Okay.
Just want to make sure. Other questions? I guess it's my turn. Did you bring a standards manual?
I think you got the link, Dr.
I went through the links. I'm asking if there's a standards manual. 4 pages of internet stuff is not a standards manual.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we were told we were here to present and answer any questions.
And I'm asking, it's the question.
No, we did not bring a standards
manual. Do you have one?
Currently, we do not, but I believe we've submitted material.
Thank you.
To board staff.
Was what I was concerned with.
No, we meaning us, not PCSAS.
Right.
PCSAS does have a standards manual.
The review criteria are online, and they're publicly available.
Review criteria are very general. Do you have standards that are applied specifically to programs with definitions and things?
I think, if I may, right now the University of Arizona is undergoing our 10-year PCSAS renewal. So I am leading the self-study for the renewal. And
so there's a self-study manual?
Yes, there are self-study guidelines that require each program to outline its pedagogical philosophy, talk about its scientific epistemology, focus on the way in which science is inherent in all of the clinical application training that it provides, and then reviews the strength and caliber of our students, and then the strength and caliber of what they are doing professionally with the 10-year follow-back period. So the notion that there is nothing, that there are no standards, in my mind is a bit of a red herring, because COA accreditation doesn't require nearly the oversight or documentation on graduates' work for their careers that PCSAS does. Nothing even remotely close. So with our accreditation, with our renewal, and all the 39-plus programs that are accredited in the country, they've gone through this long-term exercise of evaluating the work of their graduates and their career trajectory. So there are standards that are online. They're not called standards. They're called review criteria.
Mm-hmm. Did you write the web page? That was almost word for word.
No, I didn't write it. No, oh. I've looked at it a lot.
Okay. I think the website's improved since last time I saw it. It's been much better stated, much clearer. Mm-hmm. I was going to congratulate you. I thought you wrote it the way you were speaking. And it's a great outline. I don't question any of that. But you can take each one of those and say, how do I meet that? And how do I objectively review that standard as I'm reviewing a program? And that's probably what the COA manual does maybe too much of. It's maybe too prescriptive. You might agree with that or not, having gone through the similar review every 7 years with the APA standards. But I'm at a loss as to the tremendous jump from 4 pages to 400 pages as to what the guidance is, other than we've got great schools, which you do, and you have great programs in those schools, which are clear. And it almost follows a British system of mentorial approaches to clinical training. And what does that clinical training consist of, what that particular student's interested in, and what the faculty who they mentor with through the process believe they need to learn, and then it's called all good. And that's without more than that, it seems to be much closer to that system, perhaps, than it is to the system we're used to accrediting.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond, I think that you're right and that there's much more flexibility in the way that training can happen, and that's really the purpose of PCSAS, you know, but in the end, they're going to have to pass the ECCC. So if we train them in some very specialized little area of knowledge, they're not going to be prepared to be able to do that. They're going to have to get clinical placements and perform well there so that they've got letters of recommendation to get internships. They're going to have to get clinical internships. And so the idea that we would be able to be so specialized in our training that we wouldn't prepare them for licensure, they just wouldn't be prepared to be successful. If they chose not to become licensed at all, not to go into practice, then it's really sort of irrelevant to issues related to licensure. And it's certainly true that we do not have a standards manual like the APA standards manual, which, as you point out, is extremely long. But I think that the very long APA manual does very little to provide clarity for programs about how to meet specific requirements. In fact, I could share with you, listserv discussions that go on for days about if we do this, will it meet the requirements for diversity training? Or if we do this, will it meet requirements for the breath training based on the COA model? So I'm not sure that all of that excruciating detail in their standards manual really helps us know how they want us to do training.
As I reviewed your issues, and I'll think specifically of our needs here in Arizona, and I'll pick on my colleague, Dr. Malott, who serves as a dean of a large program at NAU, which offers a PhD in counseling psychology, PhD in educational psychology, an EdD in educational psychology, now a PsyD in clinical psychology. Would any of those state programs from a large state university be eligible for PCSAS accreditation?
Mr. Chairman, anybody is eligible for PCSAS accreditation. Would they be competitive for PCSAS accreditation? Probably not, because they have a very different training model. And I think that's the whole goal here, is for programs to have different kinds of training models with accreditation systems that support those models. I would expect that those programs would probably go in under the COA because their model of training is more consistent with the COA model.
So a large university with a PsyD degree in your training model could be accepted?
If it holds a clinical science training model. So, for example, the PsyD program at Rutgers has a clinical science model, and if they wanted to pursue PCSAS accreditation, they could.
Okay. It's the training model, not the degree.
Correct.
Counseling psychology, not considered science?
Of course it's considered science. It's not, if the program doesn't self-identify as having a clinical science model, then they wouldn't be eligible for this accreditation program. So it's really up to the program in terms of how they identify themselves and the kind of training they do. I guess it makes sense also to think broadly about the why now question for this accreditation system. And all of us are really on the front line of trying to deal with this tremendous mental health burden in this country. And we need to face some very serious facts. We're not doing that well. We're just not. And part of what we're trying to do here, part of the broader goal, is not just to increase the shortfall of clinicians in the community. It is to try to allow clinical researchers room for innovation in training programs and the kind of innovation that may potentially yield some breakthroughs. And I don't mean, you know, one and done kinds of things, but I mean real systematic long-term kinds of building blocks that can ease the burden of mental health that we're all trying to ameliorate and work on together. And I think that's a very important backdrop for all of this. And what does flexibility really mean? Well, it means that the COA has 5 required breadth area courses that you need to fill, and a PCSAS accredited program, while is dictated to have courses in ethics, to focus on diversity, to have intervention and assessment training, to have psychopathology coverage, may choose to use those 5 areas differently and intersect, say, with policy and intervention science, policy and assessment, evaluation science and intervention. So there are all kinds of different ways and newer models that are newer ways of thinking about doing training that emerge from this that may potentially be very, very generative. So the fundamental starting point here, or is it the end point? It's one of the starting point or the end point, is essentially that there are multiple and diverse ways to train qualified clinical psychologists. And you can get to the same basic endpoint through very different input routes. And that's the sort of foundation of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have no question you get the same point through many avenues. I found incredibly skilled clinicians graduating from non-science-based programs. CIDs, for example, and found incredibly talented clinicians, very helpful in many of our programs, who have EdDs and PhDs in counseling psychology, don't have a heavy science background or research background. I'm very encouraged by movements in the field toward outcome measurement and using outcome measurement in clinical work, cutting length of stays, increasing percentages of reliable change. Michael Lampert's work, Bruce Wampolt's work, and those folks who I think are fairly highly regarded. Bruce Wampolt was pretty much the head of APA's evidence-based practice presidential committee. A counseling psychologist with a counseling background who does research in counseling. But he and his students in his program, not something that matches your accreditation. It just seems very limited to me when you say your goal is to increase the results of behavioral health. And gosh, there are some great programs out there doing that and really, really trying to impact on things. And so many of our colleagues that I see are doing that are coming from the non-heavy clinical research programs. And I certainly appreciate clinical research programs. It's my generation. That you're almost talking about going back into what we had in school. I don't have a problem with that. I saw clinical as we used to call it rat lab, but as they became more applied, it became a real research application. And I have a good appreciation of that. But they're very small programs. And certainly didn't turn out. And I think in many ways that's how we gave rise to the licensed counseling system, is we couldn't meet the need. And we're still not meeting the need, as you appropriately say. And the need grows every day. And I know I work in a very large public health system. I need psychologists. I could hire 10 more today. I got more than a dozen working for me now, and I can't get enough. But who am I finding? People who want to work with people, who want to work with the indigent, who want to work in the public. Not people who really want to do research. They want to see tough cases and tough clients and what have you. Be research informed, which I think is great and huge. But do we need to spend the time training people in that? Is that really it? A personal question I have. I think we need all of them. I think we need the school folks. Right now, we measure outcomes on every case and every patient, and my best outcomes are coming out of in-school-based programs, folks who understand the school system, who understand 504 and understand IEPs and understand developmental issues with kids. It's a huge, huge area, and we can't meet the demand there. I just don't see this as meeting that, per se, or contributing to helping meet that. I'm not opposed to a neat accreditation for research. I think you should judge a program on the kind of things you're talking about in those research areas, not just on the dollars that you bring in, which is the way we've judged universities for years. One of the top research universities, you open a magazine and it's all who brings in how much money.
But there's no need to accredit a program if it just has a research framework. So these are clinical psychology programs. 73% in PCSAS's latest, 75% of PCSAS's latest survey data on their outcomes suggest that the 75% of the graduates are working in direct service positions. They're working in the kinds of things your programs you're describing. They're working right in the trenches. And there are many of us on my faculty, at least, who have clinic days. We're doing clinical work while we're training our students in the context of our studies, in the context of our evaluation programs. I guess one way I would sort of frame the whole discussion to the board, I think we're looking at different sides of the same coin here. And I would say rather than our desire here today to be exclusive in any way, all PCSAS is asking for is to just be on a level playing field with COA. It's demonstrated itself to be legitimate, has the support of major organizations in the field who are gatekeepers of training in the same way that the board is a gatekeeper of the readiness for clinical practice. And So it's really about the parity bill is really about leveling the playing field for graduates of PCSAS programs.
And all your programs are APA accrued.
Right now, yes.
Why create a new system if APA approval, which is universally recognized in all the jurisdictions, is still allowing you to run this type of program, develop this type of teaching approach and this type of mentality? Why a separate system? You're already doing it.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that you're right. We're already doing it, but we're doing it under constraints of a system that makes it very difficult to have the kind of flexible curriculum that allows us to train people in innovative ways that we want to train them. And so that's really the reason for PCSAS. But I agree with everything that you said. You know, we need more of all of them. Mm-hmm. And we need to meet the needs. And I think we can disagree, you know, about whether this is one of the pieces that is going to help us move forward and have more effective treatments and push those treatments out to the people who are providing them, whether they come from PhD programs or PsyD programs or counseling psychology programs. But I think, you know, what we're really trying to do is give the programs the opportunity to have the kind of innovative training that might lead to, you know, real change in this field. And again, I think we can, you know, disagree on whether that's the way to do it, but that's the purpose of it.
Does APS use the APA ethics code? You're both members of APS, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, with respect to your question and the earlier question, I think the idea of adhering to ethical standards is more to recognize that APA is not the only organization that provides ethical standards, right? So that, you know, APA does not define for the world what is ethical behavior or practice. I don't know offhand whether APS makes reference to APA's ethics guidelines in its public materials.
But what is the basis for, at one level, like, why would it? APS is a professional organization, not PCSAS. APS is a professional organization for all of psychology and psychological science. The ethics code, of course, dictates how we behave as a profession toward each other and practically, but when it comes to protecting the public, the rubber meets the road with licensure, and it's incumbent on everyone who's licensed to adhere to the code of conduct.
That's why I'm trying to spell it out, because it's actually written into our law. And we have to look for violations or variances from practice, from our statute, from our rules, and from the code of ethics. A code of ethics that, you're saying there are lots of them, and we follow something, but our law says you follow the APA one. And for some reason, you seem to want to avoid saying that's there.
Well, Mr. Graber, we're not PCSAS, so we're not APS, so we can't really speak to. I'm just telling you that my understanding is that it's meant to be broader than that. I don't think it's meant to be excluding APA standards for ethics.
No, but, you're teaching APA standards. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But I believe the reality is, if they get licensed, they will be upheld to the ethics that are in our statute, which are those ethics.
Yes.
So they'll be dealing with that, whether.
Correct. Let me ask you a question that doesn't affect any of us today. But 7, 8, 9, 10 years down the road, I'll be long gone from here. U of A has expressed an interest in dropping APA and being PCSAS. You're listed on your webpage as saying so, along with several other universities. So they go through a good, strong program at U of A, and they pick up a license here. And 54 other jurisdictions in the country don't recognize their training because they've dropped APA. Why would you do that to people?
To our students?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a good question. And the bigger question is, what does a graduate program need to do to ultimately ensure for the professional trajectories of its students? So our faculty is having a tremendous debate about what would be the right time if the parity was to go through this year. We're not going to drop COA accreditation because we can't do that to our graduate students, because the constellation of other states doesn't line up. But maybe there would be a way in which, well, we have all the data where our graduates are licensed, and if we can, you know, provide some informed consent to people and say, these are the states we know about that will provide for parity for PCSAS, and you can get licensed in these other states, and, you know, these are states where it might not necessarily be possible, and provide that for people coming in and have a long sort of glide path into this transition, we would do it. I mean, first and foremost, the well-being of our students is paramount, because we take tremendous, moral responsibility for what happens to them after they graduate. So it's really important to us. So we don't make that decision with any sort of degree of lightheartedness at all. We are in a very big and serious debate about how that's going to happen.
I think it's a huge issue, and one that needs to be looked at. I have 10 more questions, but I want to hog all the time if other folks want. So, 2 years ago at APA, and I go to a lot of different oddball meetings and run into PCSAS proponents, so we have multiple discussions. 2 years ago in San Francisco, the PCSAS presentation specifically excluded ASPPB, and that was a huge issue, and we're asked not to participate in it. This is the association of all the state boards. I have an understanding of why you're not interested in talking with state boards.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, it's actually quite the opposite. We have written, I'm involved in the Academy of Psychological Clinical Science, a professional organization that is aligned with PCSAS, and I'm president of the executive committee of the Academy, and the Academy wrote a letter to ASPPB asking them to engage in a discussion with us about about accreditation, about recognizing PCSAS, and essentially provide them with all of the data about PCSAS and ask them to respond to a series of questions. And the response we got, and I'd be happy to share the letter back with the board, the response we got was basically, we talked and we don't want to talk further. We talked internally and we don't want to talk with you about it. I know that the PCSAS folks are engaged in a conversation with ASPPB because it would be tremendous for ASPPB to do effectively what CUDCUP, the Council of University Directors of Psychology Programs, and APIC have done, to sort of have a discussion with PCSAS folks and try to, you know, try to come to terms with the fact that we are operating in a dual accreditor environment. But my experience has been, and having personally reached out to ASPPB, that they were not super willing to engage with us. So I don't, I mean, that's been my experience at the national level with them. I don't know if, Will, you'd want to say more.
Interesting. National organization that accredits PCSAS is the VA?
CHEA, Council for Higher Education.
A membership organization. I don't want to get into the politics of APIC and bylaws change that was forced upon them to move you guys away from DOE, but again, I'm hogging.
Just to go back, the reason they're here is to get our input in regards to going to the legislature with this potential bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we wanted to let you know that we are going to be approaching the legislature with the bill this year that was similar to the bill that we introduced 2 years ago, not the one that we introduced last year, the much more simple fix. And just asking questions, having that transparent conversation with the board in hopes to either get your support or at the very least understand where the board will be, because in previous years you all have showed up to committee to oppose.
So I just want to make a comment, and the comment is the way APA works in our statutes is basically it addresses the curriculum requirements. It does not address any other component that is required for licensure. So basically, in order for somebody to get licensed in Arizona, you have to have completed organized training program. As part of the organized training program, and anyone, you can come from an APA accredited program or you can come from a non-APA accredited program. If you come from an APA accredited program, we do not review the curriculum requirements. We say check, and then so that is the only advantage an APA accredited student gets if they apply for licensure in Arizona. If they come from a non-accredited program, then we do review their coursework and make sure that they have the different coursework requirements. All other requirements as specified in our statutes are reviewed regardless of the kind of training you complete, APA, non-APA. Mm-hmm. So previous to 2013, we did not have a provision in our statutes for APA approval. All students were reviewed for everything. And then somewhere around 2000, I could be wrong in my dates.
It's earlier.
Earlier?
It has to be earlier because the name is incorrect in the statute. So COA changed their name before 2010.
Okay, yeah. So it was somewhere in that time. Mm-hmm. I got on the board in 2006.
Yeah, it was about 2007, 2008, something in that.
Okay. But when I first started, it wasn't. That's the only thing I remember, because I remember reviewing everybody's coursework. And so then we introduced that legislation that if you had APA basically you get a pass on one requirement, meaning you don't have to prove you've had all of these courses.
But that APA accredited school has to have taught those courses.
No, we just assume that APA, because they're coming from an APA program, that coursework is covered.
So we would assume that coursework you would cover?
Go
ahead.
No, I was saying essentially the as I understand the ARS, the COA accreditation, APA accreditation says the curriculum in an APA accredited program is essentially good enough. And in some ways, it's a safeguard for the board too, because the statute APA standards on accreditation just changed. So now the board, the specific educational requirements are out of compliance. But so if you say the accreditation counts, then you can dictate what the requirements are, but it's at the level of the accredited program.
Yeah, so the APA actually has changed their curriculum requirements. They've added a few more components. So we say APA, or you need to meet these, which were originally part of APA, but APA has modified. So the requirements that we have are not quite in sync with what APA requires. There's a slight difference.
But they used to be based specifically on APA requirements.
So when APA has changed, our statutes haven't changed. But since we accept APA. So that's the main thing. Then every applicant to the board has to complete a practicum or internship, a postdoc. They have to have licensed supervisor. And that's true for anybody, and pass the exam, mm-hmm. unless it's universal recognition.
All right. And your curriculum basically follows what's in the statute as far as what we have listed?
They have more flexibility.
More flexibility.
That's the point of BCSAS, to not have to follow.
So APA has also changed some of that recently. And APA has changed it to... it's really interesting, again, as our guests have indicated. They said, you could take maybe these GRE psych exam, but then you need to ensure that students have graduate level knowledge. So you're not quite sure. When I was writing an answer to that question, I said, okay, if you can accept the GRE, that's showing that they have basic undergraduate level knowledge, but then you have to ensure they have graduate level knowledge. Could you do that in the form of an exam, and that's okay? They've allowed for more flexibility in how you meet those six or seven core areas. And so programs are wrestling, and it's really, we keep testing and then seeing if it passes. So there's a little bit more flexibility in how you meet those core areas of knowledge. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. So that's kind of where we stand. So it's that one piece where you have the advantage when you come from an APA, and I see it as an advantage to us board members, having reviewed, as I was just counting, over probably 2,000 applicants over the last 14 years. So, going through every coursework, and I would compare it to
our statutes now out of date.
No. Our statutes, we have these six, but we have APA. So people who come from not APA, we check them according to those different criteria.
Of the 64 jurisdictions, there are only 12 that are APA exclusive.
12?
12.
I thought it was less.
I thought it was less, too, but I got yelled at the other day.
I had Florida, Oklahoma, and Utah. Some require APA-approved internships.
At the SIPAC commissioners meeting, we were talking about accepting each other's licensees. Mm-hmm. And our friends at Georgia sat there and said, you guys from Arizona wouldn't be acceptable to practice under SIPAC in my state. And I said, why the hell is that? And it's because we are one of the looser states in terms of accepting equivalency from damn near anything. So that APA or Georgia, you must come from an APA program. Now, I didn't know that. I thought that was odd. So I went to the ASPPB folks and said, how many states are like that? Or jurisdictions, it would count the Canadian system as well, but there's 12. But we're considered one of the looser states in that we'll accept equivalency of darn near anything that meets a minimum shell of coursework. And that's what's spelled out is what they're now considering the old APA coursework stuff, which, to be truthful with you, follows the Model Practices Act. So that's where we got it from. We didn't make it up. It comes directly out of the Model Practices Act. That helped.
Thanks.
So, other questions for our distinguished professors? What do you want from us?
Again, thank you for your time. We really wanted to come and have this conversation. We want to be as transparent with the board as possible. I will continue to be in contact with your executive director as we find a bill sponsor. I will make sure she sees the language before it is filed. And we hope to, if you continue to work with the board, if it is something that you all would like to support, we would like that. If the board decides to take opposition, it would be great if you could just let us know so we're moving into the session that way.
But let me tell you what my thoughts are as chair. In all fairness, the board is going through a transition. We have new members appointed last week who are not here. And their first in-person meeting with us will be
in January.
So I'm going to table any position from this board until it's fair to get input, involvement of our new board members. Otherwise, you'd probably come out on the same vote you had last time. So I think it's unreasonable for me to force something. I'd like there. Secondly, I won't be chair in January. So I think that your new chair may direct and assist the board in a different direction. So I'm, in all honesty, trying to be as fair as I can. And I'm going to kind of leave it with there. Do I have hesitation and concerns? Yeah. I think there are other things that are more pressing and important for the universities to be doing. I think there are more pressing and important things for PCSAS and APA and COA and other groups to be focusing on. And some of that you brought up, that we suck in terms of delivering what's needed to the most people out there. And I wish we could spend time figuring out how to do some of that before we fought with each other about who's got the best accreditation system. We're training a lot of people, but not enough, and we're not getting enough service out to folks, and I'd rather spend time on those issues. But this is important to you guys, and as you say, every university I've graduated from, U of A and ASU and USC are all part of this. And I kind of got a founder's membership in the old American Psychological Society, which is the predecessor of APS. So I certainly agree with some of those models. Some of my best friends are former presidents of Beth Loftus and what have you of APS. I'm not opposed to this system. I respect it. But I also want mobility, and I want licensing to work in Arizona and other places. And, if we can pull boards together to work together, that makes the most sense to me for the most mobility that we can get in our system. And that's what I'm looking for. And not divisions, not more little separate groups.
Could I add something?
Yeah.
So one of the things I just want to add, I'm sure some of you are familiar with SARA. I wish I could remember what it stood for. But that's to do with mobility and licensing. And now we are expected to inform all our students, And right now they're focusing on online programs, but I've heard they're moving towards other programs that lead to certification and licensure. Until every state except PCSAS, I would really caution universities not to drop APA, because as Dr. Bohansky just noted, we have 12 states that exclude non-APA programs. Now, I personally do not believe licensing law should include you know, they should always have the equivalent, because it's the whole private versus, you know, some private organization dictating what state statutes and rules. It should always be a state decision, not using somebody that we pay a lot of money to dictating what our state statutes would say. So I don't know that I'm allowed to give advice, but my legal attorney here can stop me. But students don't understand this coming in. And if you drop one for the other and they come here and they move to Florida, Georgia, Oklahoma, Utah, they're not going to be licensed. And they're going to be really upset. And that will result in new legislation like SARA and all the legislations we have to deal with. So, you know, as an administrator at a university, I'm very, very conscious, because we get, that's the complaints I get. I got this degree and now it's useless. I can't get licensed. And ultimately, most of our graduates want to get licensed, regardless of whether they use it or not. So that's just a friendly piece of advice. I would wait for all 50 states.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And as my colleague here said, you know, our students come first, and we will certainly not be making any changes that are going to jeopardize their career opportunities. And I think, you know, these same conversations are happening in lots of other states. And so it's a question of what will the landscape look like, say, 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, personally, so again, thank you all for your time. I really appreciate the thoughtful comments and questions. I guess in my mind, it would be great for Arizona to get out ahead on all of this, for PCSAS parity to be here, for us to work with ASPPB about portability and mobility, and for the broad national movement to recognize the legitimacy of both groups so that there can be movement. And so I guess on our end, we want to see a sort of ceasefire in any turf wars that have to do with who controls what and how it should be, to allow appropriately accredited students from appropriately accredited programs to move around and serve the communities that need it. So I think that would be a very laudable goal for us to work together on.
And, you know, another piece, I'm not involved at all with PCCAS or anything. I'm a counseling psychologist, so I am excluded. And I think that's where Dr. Bohansky is definitely has made really, which I appreciate. But psychological science is a science, and I really value. I was a graduate dean for many, many years, and I worked with my science colleagues across the university. And so I really appreciated learning on the science of science, you know, and psychology going that way is a wonderful, wonderful practice and procedure. And I read through the standards in terms of how you do your laboratories and clinical, you know, that resonates with my biology colleagues and chemistry colleagues. And so we are starting to see parity with the hard sciences, as we call them. And so especially being a graduate dean where I got exposed to how the hard sciences did it and how we did it, you know, those differences. So that's, you know, I applaud that. And, you know, it's great to see that, because we need good science to help with all the problems we are seeing. So, you know, language is important too. And I hope PCCAS and all of that change the language. You know, I like APA's term now of health service psychology. That is such a broad, inclusive term that includes school psychs and counseling psychs and clinical psychs and clinical science. You know, such a broad term, health service. After all, we are in the business of delivering health, so, you know, the health service delivery model. And throughout the language, you know, which, you know, rubs some of us the wrong way, just clinical psychology. You don't have that term, you're out, you know. And so I hope, and APA was pretty exclusive in the old days, and, you know, they've become more broad. And so we're going back to kind of, I mean, that's just personal. I mean, it's nothing to do with what. So I hope that language gets, you know, and so we're really focusing on the research and the science, because that's what's really important here. Mm-hmm. And when we start throwing in very exclusive terms, then we exclude. There are some really great counseling psych programs that are doing psychological science. After all, they are psychologists too. So I don't know whether you all have a chance to influence a national discussion, but I thought I should throw in my two cents.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll give you my last two cents as well. My preference would be to see
the APA and the PCSAS people get together and come up with one set of standards they could all agree on, so we got one system and we don't have to have this. As a legislator said to me 2 years ago, what the hell are we going to do when a third group comes along with another brighter idea? Maybe we should just get rid of all of them. And we look silly when we fight each other, but whenever you put two psychologists in a room, you end up with three opinions, and that's a problem. As many of you know, I teach in China. I've been doing that for 10 years. 2 years ago, the Chinese government canceled all the clinical psychology licenses in the country. They're all gone. And that's their way of starting over. I think ours may be a little bit crazy because it ends up looking like we fight each other and we piss and moan about different stuff. But at least we haven't canceled every license in the country and starting over again. Although I'm happy to be involved in the start over and having input into that there. I'm equally happy that we have the opportunity to keep doing our job to protect the public, and they need to keep doing their job to train good clinicians. And I wish the hell they'd take their system and the APA system and put them together to one system and say, this is what makes sense. Because we're heading the way the dental profession went, and that's with multiple national accreditation groups and multiple national tests, and depends on what section of the country you come from. It's like the old neuropsych folks used to be, or the Rorschach folks used to be. It depended on where you trained, what system you used. And we got to get together. So thank you for coming,
you.
Folks. And
thank you.
We will have this on the agenda on January, if I can be so bold as to add something to the agenda. And if we need to take a stand, there will be our bill open because this is a sunset year. So if we agree to add you in, we'll probably add you into our bill. That would save you the money of running your own and having it altered. And if we don't agree and put it into our bill, we'll be running our bill, adding awful things like fingerprinting and yada, 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 all those hot topics. So that that bill will be going through probably the same committee of references as what yours was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have an hour.
We're going to get done at 3.
I predicted 3. So we have to continue a couple other discussions, which means we'll be going to be here all night. Anyway, let's go back to what we tabled, which is
16.
We have tabled approving Dr. Rivera?
Yes.
And we've had lengthy discussions as to what this and that means. And now it's time to further the discussion.
One of the questions, is in the statute, because the statute lays is regarding out-of-state applications and residents. There's a clause in there that the person must at least have a license from one other state in the discipline applied for, and at the same practice level as determined by the regulating entity. That seemed to be the clause that we're all kind of tripping over. What does that mean? Does that mean when it says as determined by the regulating entity, meaning they have to meet our qualifications? Or is it that the qualifications that were approved by the state that they came from is enough? I guess I'd ask too is, you know, how this statute pertains to all boards and all licenses and certificates. It just, you know, how are we all applying that? Because I do want to make sure, you know, for me, everybody's being treated equally fairly. You know, maybe an idea is to ask for an opinion from the Attorney General's office on what that means, so that we are all, I think we have some differing opinions, but, you know, let's get an understanding globally over all of the different agencies of what does that clause mean. The rest of it's pretty clear. You know, they have to have certain education. They can't have any type of discipline imposed on them, yada, yada. But that one clause, the practicing level as determined by the regulating entity, what does that mean? Was the intent that they have to meet our standards? They don't have to meet our standards? Because that's kind of what side do we fall on? And again, I think we want to make sure that we're interpreting it the same way as possibly other boards are, so that we're treating people equitably. Just a thought.
So this is Dinar. My understanding of same practice level is the practice level or the scope of practice that is defined by the jurisdiction in which the applicant already possesses a license. And if that practice level is at the same level. So, for example, our board has two practice levels, a psychologist and a behavioral analyst. And if the applicant has the practice level of a psychologist in their licensing jurisdiction, they would be at the same practice level as a licensed psychologist in Arizona.
I think that's not quite accurate, sir. A behavior analyst is a separate profession from psychology and handles itself separately with its own requirements, its own practice certifications, and its own members on the board. In the psychology licensure, we have really two levels of practice. One is independent, and that means that you have the education requirements and have passed the national boards. The second is what we call a temporary license, in which you have the education requirements, but you have not passed the national boards. As we sit and look at this law, I think many of us are saying, and I agree with my colleague here, Ms. Shreve, that we should ask for an attorney general's opinion. I read it that, and have been advised to what it says by my attorney, that it's our practice levels. We're admitting them to practice in our state, and they must meet our practice levels. Now, the candidate here, I believe, meets a practice level. He meets the practice level of having the education but not taking passing the national board. So it would be fine to license him at the temporary level and not at the independent level. And I would have no problem doing that. but that's what I've been advised. That's the way I read it. And I guess each of us has to look at it until we have an attorney general's opinion.
My thoughts is it just felt like we were kind of divided or not sure. I don't want to deny somebody.
Correct.
And I don't want to, you know, I think we want to just make sure we're all following the same beat of the drum. Let's ask the state attorney general what the interpretation is of that. Does it mean as determined by the regulating entity? Is that our statutes? Is that, again, are we just relying on the state that they came from or territory? Because it can be interpreted two different ways, and that's what I'm hearing, and I'd rather just that we ask for an opinion as opposed to maybe make the wrong or right decision and not be sure about it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I believe that before the board met to meet in executive session that there was a motion on the table, a motion to approve the license under universal recognition that was seconded. So that the discussion now is appropriate, of course, but I just wanted to remind the board
yes.
that.
Oh, was it? Thank you. We did have a motion and a second, and I opened it up for discussion, and we're still in that discussion.
Just, I guess, the other view that I think the board member on the phone mentioned, when I've read the rule, excuse me, the law, the universal recognition law, I saw it as if somebody in any jurisdiction is licensed at the independent level, then that is the jurisdiction rather than our interpretation of what the level is. So I guess what we're saying is we need maybe a more formal opinion from our Attorney General on how to interpret it. Because, you know, the way I look at it, this licensee in Puerto Rico would be eligible here as per universal recognition law.
So is it?
You know, but if there is another way of viewing that, and we've done this before, is like, well, maybe it's not really the same kind of practice level in Puerto Rico that it is here. Well, if it's independent, it's independent. So
that would be my thought, because for me, independent means you're practicing without supervision. And if he was practicing independently and then we come here and say he has to receive supervision, that seems to be different. That is different practice levels. And then the other issue is the way the statute reads is the person previously passed an examination required for the license or certification if required by the other state.
So if it wasn't required, they didn't even have to pass one.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. I mean,
again, this law was written for every occupation in the state.
I cut my own hair.
Yep.
I mean, there's boards have different, there's different levels of protecting the public. I've cut myself, so I understand why. But
you're practicing barbering without a license?
Not of other people.
Yeah. It's his hand. It's good.
So, to me, it's this law lowers the standards of practice in Arizona.
Yes, it does.
But it was passed. And I mean, I think that I would like to see us try to clarify the aspects of this as they pertain to this board in dealing with legislature, if that's even possible. But I don't know how we deny the current application based on this law.
I think one of the things, we denied a license, I think last month or something. We have had a precedent, not in this particular type of case, but we had a situation that came up a year and a half ago or 2 years when, or 3 years, I forget when, it was to do with the renewal application, and the question was very confusing, and so we had a whole bunch of people that got, and then we had, when the 20th person came before the board and made a case, and we did go back and reverse those previous decisions. So we have a precedent, you know, if we realize that we were kind of, you know, we did reverse the decision of the first 7 or 8 that we made.
Right.
So I think we need to resolve this one and then maybe go back and look.
Because I'm not sure I think the last one would need to be looked at. Right. And then of course, it could be read, and maybe this is just, it could almost be read that, you know, that the person is currently licensed or certified in at least one other state in the discipline applied for at the same practice level as determined by the regulating entity. It could be, is it us regulating entity?
Or is it them?
Or them. Because it's talking about, you could read it almost, you know, them. He has same practice level as determined by the regulating entity, which would be in Puerto Rico. But again, I think that's where we all seem to have a little issue. But, you know, maybe we vote and find out. I don't know.
I mean, this says that we're taking other states and territories as being competent, and if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us, regardless of
that's
what.
That's the plain language.
Right. And while I don't like that, I think there are potential concerns for education, like we've already seen, now for examination, and then there's going to be some issues with supervision come up too. I mean, those are the three areas, and so I think if we can somehow address that, but as it's written now, I don't.
I don't know that we're going to get a realistic legal opinion very quickly. I read it, I have had it read to me as our, meaning this regulatory body's, levels of practice. We're taking something from another state and seeing where it fits here. We've had someone apply already with a master's degree.
Yeah, that was it.
Tried to put it in, it didn't fit. So that was rejected. This one comes in, it's from an APA approved school. He has the education. He's not taken our national boards, which all 50 states have. I cannot believe that this law was meant to avoid the national boards in any field, nursing, medicine, psychology, but that if we have a practice level before taking the national boards, we could offer that license to him, that's what he, where he's at. And then his letter in his application says he will do that. So that's one view of it. Is it right? I don't know if it's right. Gosh, I sure wish that 64 out of 64 took the test instead of 63 out of 64. And we just happened to get an applicant from the one place, that doesn't take the national boards.
And that's the only issue, is it says an examination, not
the examination.
A nationally right. accepted examination.
But it I don't know what the barber exam is, and I don't know that there's a national one. This law covers the barbers and the massage therapists and the nail technicians and everybody in the state.
Right.
So you can't put that too specific a wording in it.
But the reality is, this is the statute. We are regulatory board. We have to go by the statute.
Yes, so I agree.
What I thought we were stumbling over was how to interpret that language, as opposed to do they have to, as determined by the regulating entities, that mean our requirements? Because the last person didn't have the EPPP, but they weren't APA certified.
No, they weren't. They didn't have a nationally accredited degree. It came from a.
Yeah, but this doesn't. But if that's may not be, if that may be the intent here, the person was practicing for many years independently. This person's practicing independently in Puerto Rico, doesn't have the EPPP. Do they have to have that? Because it does say if required by the other state. I think we have to live within what the statute says. It's awfully broad, and you're right. It covers every license and certificate. But that's why I thought if we asked for an opinion, I would have, maybe the other boards are struggling too, or if not, how are the other boards interpreting it? Clearly, is it across the board? I mean, I don't think we want to be, I think we want to, there needs to be some consistent within the state on how the boards are interpreting this. If it's broadly, then I think he would apply. He would be able to practice here. The way it's kind of, if it required by the other state. Well, the other state didn't require it.
So I have a suggestion. My suggestion is I'm a little, because the applicant indicated that he would like to take the exam, if we approve his licensure today, he's ineligible to take the exam, because you have to indicate that you want to take the exam. And we have to approve that. You can't just go take the exam on your own. And I would hate to, and we do this with our postdocs too. Some of our students want to have the postdoc on their record, because you cannot do a postdoc after your license. You have to do it before you're licensed. So should we table the application? That's one option. In the meet, you know, and ask the candidate if he wants to take the exam, because then we would have to approve him under the temporary licensure. Since he's indicated that in his application, I'd hate to deny him that opportunity to take the exam. So I don't know. I'm just
going I'm all for that approach. I'd like to give the guy a temporary license tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And not even wait. But I, you know, he said he's willing to go take the exam. I think he's being as cooperative as any applicant can be. I'd certainly like to be responsive. I'd like to get him a temporary license and invite him to take the exam and get him his full license. I'm good with that.
But he didn't apply for that.
He didn't apply for
that. He applied, it's for him to get
it. Yeah, temporary license is a whole different application process.
He applied for a license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
But we also sometimes go back to the applicant and say, based on what you said in here,
what do you want?
Also, something you mm-hmm. seem to be considering, which one do you want? And so we table that to find out, while also requesting an opinion from the AG.
That's kind of what I'm saying, you know, and that gives us a little more time. I don't know whether that is.
I mean, we want to do this right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chairman. You know, I haven't applied for licensure for a long time, but I think he's saying, I want a license, mm-hmm. and if I have to, I'll do it. I don't think it'd be appropriate to say, well, we think maybe you should. Let's have you do that and get a temporary license. I think it...
No, we're not telling him maybe you should, but we just need to ask him.
Well, I think if necessary.
Well, but like Dr. Bukhansky said, if he doesn't take the ECCC, then that is also going to hinder his ability to get licensed in other states. Right. And so just making sure he's aware of that if we issue the license, he can no longer take the ECCC.
Here. He might have to take it if he moves to California.
True. Okay. So, yeah, I guess you're right. He could. He still could take it.
If he moves to another state that requires it, which we've done. And I mean, I can see where the statute originated from. I mean, I think we've had this conversation at this very board. We had a psychologist who was licensed for 35 years, yes. moved to Arizona, never took the exam. And we said, guess what? You know, yes, you got to go take the exam because our statute requires it. And, you know, we're like, oh, you got to go take the ethics class because our statute requires it. And we're like, wow.
Yeah, and those are stupid decisions, but we were forced to make them because of the law.
Yeah. So this law gives us that opportunity to recognize those distinguished psychologists and their years of service.
Well, right, and we've approved almost all of them. There's only been. Mm-hmm.
But some have gone away. They're like, I'm not going to go back to school and take a class.
So we have a motion on the table, right?
Uh-huh.
To approve, right?
So,
yeah, motion and a second.
Any further discussion? The motion is to pass this license through. Yes, Kat.
I just had a thought that has there been any research to know if the exam taken in Puerto Rico, how it stands with the ECCC? Is there any equivalency research that's been done since he got he passed the Puerto Rican exam? It was just a question. I didn't know.
That's the point, is he just passed their exam. It was an exam. So, and I don't, again, I guess that's not even, the question is, I think what we were discussing is, do they have to meet the exact letter in the law?
I can tell you that no other state recognizes that exam, and for a variety of reasons. So the other precedent you're setting by giving someone a license here without taking the national exam is you have dozens and dozens of Arizona residents who have every bit of an educational requirement and experiential background of this person who have not taken or have not successfully taken the exam.
And that's okay if that's what this statute means. I think what we were, there was, what I was listening to was that there was a differencing on how they were interpreting it. So I guess I would come back to, do we ask the Attorney General for an interpretation of that, or assuming that that's what it is?
Another interpretation would be if they said that, say, well, if you're in a jurisdiction that requires a different exam, I guess we'll look at that, because Puerto Rico indeed has one. So he did pass something. If they're saying we didn't pass ECCC and we don't want to take any, say, well, that doesn't work.
Mr. Chair, I also would add, you know, I think it goes back to what Ms. Shreve's saying, is that we're not clear as to what the interpretation is. And I agree, we have been advised that it would be our regulatory board. However, I think if there's hesitation, I think further clarification would be needed. The other thing is there's not clarity as to what defines practice level. And so we have denied, you know, or I don't even know if it was an application we saw or an inquiry, I don't remember, but we have had a master level individual that we have deemed to not be at the same practice level. And so if we're going to call practice level the degree type, is there more to practice level that we should be defining and having some sort of policy and guidance on? Or are we going to talk about practice level as it comes to temporary versus independent? And what does that look like? Or is it both? I mean, that's the part I think that's the sticking point, is we don't have a definition of practice level. And even if we did, there doesn't seem to be consensus on who is the regulating body.
Right. So
Ms. Galvin said we were the regulating entity.
Well, yes.
A lot of it, and that could be, but what is that? Same practice level is determined by the regulating entity. Does that mean our statutes? Does that mean?
I
thought the intent of the statute was allow that you didn't have to meet everything that this state required. You just had to have that license and experience. So that's what I thought the intent was when it was going through and all this stuff that I've read about. And it is, but you know, it is broadly written. I think we were all, there was just a, we need to be sure what the answer is. We vote yes, we set a precedence. We vote no, we've set a precedence. And we want to make sure, I do, that we're comfortable with, you know, that we feel like we are in the right position.
Could we not table it?
Yes, you can table it.
This, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this application is brought to you today following a request for additional information. So I am not certain. I'm looking at our licensing administrator for her expertise. We are only afforded one opportunity to request.
Oh, no. We've done second and third. No, we do.
Okay. Beg your pardon then.
Yeah. And by tabling it, it means we're taking no action, so it doesn't, it's not even a request for additional information.
Okay.
I think we are trying to clarify in our minds what exactly what practice and who the regulating board is. So before we can render a fair decision for the candidate, we're not asking the candidate for additional information, but in likelihood we need it, we could. There's nothing that restricts our board from going back the second or even the third time.
Okay, and to further clarify my understanding then, we don't encounter any issues with respect to the substantive review time frame either, because it is 240 days. Is that correct?
After the FAQ, I'm sorry, what am I thinking? Fair, the first additional, excuse me, information requests, after that's been issued, the applicant has 240 days to respond. The board has 90 days, I believe, for the substantive review. I'm pulling up the time frame right,
thank you,
right now.
So we are at 30 days right now, correct? Not even 30 days, because we looked at it on
November.
When did we get the?
Well, the substantive review time frame begins the date that I send the administratively complete notice. I'd have to look in his file to see exactly when that was. But that's when the substantive review starts. It will stop, the clock stops when the letter goes out, that first additional information request letter, it stops then. And it starts again once he has submitted what was requested. Mm-hmm. And so we have, I'd have to
I think look at the calculations. We are good on time for right now.
We should be okay. Yeah. I think we could do another month if we have to.
But will we get a response from AG in a month? Probably not.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Mr. Harris, and I think it's more just procedural, but if not, please stop me. I am just thinking as far as options, if we, because I'm also concerned about the time, because if it's going to take three, four, you know, several months for the AG's office to get us an answer, we aren't going to have that amount of time for the applicant. But is it true, regardless of which direction it goes, is it true to say that potential guidance from the AG's office could give rationale as to why the previous actions wouldn't set precedents, that we would have additional information at that point to then guide our decision for other applications?
That's a good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, if I understand the question correctly, if you request an AG opinion and assuming that one is issued, that AG opinion will answer the question that you ask the office to answer. And so it's difficult for me to, you know, answer your question specifically because I'm not sure what the question that you'll ask our office to answer and what its impact will be, not only on this application, but in, you know, prior actions that the board may have taken.
And as far as impact specific to just future, so if we're saying that we're seeking clarification because we don't have a consensus on a specific, whether it's we're talking about this one or any, on any stance, we don't have consensus on interpretation of the actual legal language. If we get information from the AG's office at a later time that says, oh, here's how we would interpret this, would it be safe to say that it's not the past cases, but moving forward, we would be able to say, you know, we're taking a different action given the new information that we have from the AG's office?
It's really difficult for me just to give you a simple yes or no. What I would submit is that you have to review every application on its own merits and, you know, do your best to interpret the law and the requirements set forth in the law to that particular application.
Okay.
I just want to confirm we have the time frames in the rules. It is 90 days, and we are at 47 days into that 90 at this time for this application.
And if we hit 90, it's automatically?
No.
What happens if we hit 90?
In violation.
Then we get out of compliance.
No, I believe that the statute states that you would need to refund the money, the application fee to the applicant, but it doesn't mean that the application itself is either granted or denied. That ultimately is the board's decision.
Okay. Mr. Attorney, if there is a motion on the table and we choose to table before voting, does that motion just hang out there, or do we need to have it retracted, or do we need to vote on it?
I think the best practice would be to, if we could have the motion, the maker of the motion withdraw it in the second, if that is the inclination of the board.
Well, we've gone into looking at timelines and dates and what have you with the idea of tabling this. So if we're going to table it, we need to withdraw the motion.
I'm willing to withdraw the motion.
Okay, we have the motion withdrawn. The second.
Second.
If there's no motion, I'll withdraw my second.
The second's withdrawn. Then I'm going to table this item, and we will move from there.
Well, but are we going to ask? Don't we need to make a request?
Yeah, we'll work with our legal counsel and executive director, and bring you back the attorney general question.
If we could formalize that, though, in the form of a motion to direct the executive director to request a formal AG opinion, and then if you could provide guidance to staff.
I so move that we direct our executive director and legal counsel to formulate the language for a formal AG opinion on implementation of aspects of this law and bring that formulation to us prior to sending it to the AG's office for our approval.
And can I amend? I think we're meant by friendly amendment. I think that it was to clarify 3240.03A1 regards to at the same practice level as determined by the regulating entity. Was it the intent? What was the intent of the legislation? Do they have to meet our requirements, or are they just the requirements of that state licensing state enough?
And who is the regulating entity? I don't know whether it's us or whether it's them.
So those two questions are what you would like to advance to the Attorney General's office for clarification of this specific statute.
And about the, can we define the practice level?
Yeah. Yeah. And to what extent? You know, is it degree? Is it, I mean, it's so vague.
Can we add the issue about the degree?
Well, the degrees already got that listed in here.
No.
It doesn't say doctoral?
It doesn't.
I think that would be important.
It can't say doctoral because this law is for everything.
Yeah, it cannot say
doctoral. No, it says, you don't get a doctoral degree in massage therapy.
No, when the person was licensed or certified by another state, there were minimum education requirements.
Okay.
And if applicable, work experience. So they have to meet the minimum education requirements from the other state.
So
Okay.
No, they have to meet the minimum education requirements for this
that's
state.
That's the question. Because that's not when you go down... In three, it talks about...
So I think the master's level, they did not have the same practice level. The Michigan license is a limited license.
Right.
It's not a full license.
Okay,
so,
okay, good. That covers that issue.
So this is already acknowledging that the other state had to have a minimum education requirement. It doesn't say what it was. So again, you know, if you read the rest of it after one, it's everything's about that state and what that they met there. So I think the part we're all not... we're having a problem with is is that where the needle lays, or is it really novel?
We just turned down an applicant with a licensed psychologist with a master's degree.
Right. And now we're questioning whether that was...
No, I'm not questioning that. They did not have a full license. They had a limited psychology. No, Michigan.
Are you talking about California?
No.
Oh, Michigan.
The California was related to the educational requirements, meaning in California... institutions did not have to be regionally accredited. But in Arizona and pretty much anywhere else, they have to be regionally accredited institutions. So that's a whole different...
That's the California case.
Right, but according to this then, that doesn't matter because you have a minimum education from that state. So again,
it still comes back to clarifying.
It still comes back to,
can we identify or determine practice level?
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, it comes down to. In the case of Michigan,
and,
go ahead.
I'm sorry for interjecting. It's a bit challenging to appear by telephone. So I think it would help if the Attorney General's office has kind of like some factual basis to evaluate the questions that we're presenting. So I think with this specific case, the factual underpinnings are that we have a certificate from the regulatory board of Puerto Rico saying that the applicant possesses a regular license. So the question that we're asking is in the context of whether that regular license scope of practice in Puerto Rico is the same as the independent psychologist license scope of practice in the state of Arizona, because that's what the applicant is applying for.
Yeah.
Well stated.
So is that motion clear?
Maybe we could have it read back so we all understand it if somebody has
it. There's several parts to it because we think we all added to it.
The original motion.
Dr. Malott moved to approve the license under universal recognition. Dr. Flowers seconded the motion.
No, that's not the motion.
That was withdrawn.
Okay. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
The motion is my motion, which was to
direct the executive director to request a formal attorney general opinion on implementation of the aspects of the law that are in question, specifically the meaning of same practice level. Does it encompass degree, examination, training, and also the aspect who is the regulating entity?
Right.
Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that pretty much sums up what the gentleman on the phone was saying is, you know, the independent compared to general.
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Thank God, no. all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. We're going to formulate an attorney general question. Yay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, then I think we need to, at least for purposes of this meeting, maybe just continued consideration of Mr. Rivera's application for universal licensure.
Yes.
We need a vote on that?
Please.
I move we continue table and continue the consideration on Mr. Rivera's license so that we can get an opinion on how to best handle this.
I'll second that.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay. The other tabled item is on the EPPP implementation date. This is the discussion we had with Dr. Turner.
I just feel there's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, you know, they keep moving the dates and so-and-so's backed out, and I don't feel comfortable.
No, do I? Mm-hmm. I'm much more comfortable going with Georgia.
Yes.
Gives everybody plenty of time to be implementing and giving pre-warning and pre-discussion and all the rest of that. So
I'm also really concerned about 5 months after you take it, you're going to get the results. So that's really restricting trade, you know. We're talking about restricting, we're hurting our citizens.
I heard multiple times.
Yeah.
So what he said, what it would be similar to the old paper pencil days, that was 3 months. That's the kind of thing I'm expecting.
Well, but I thought he said they were going to take all of the scores for 5 months. Mm-hmm.
That's a period that's going to collect scores, yeah. If we don't join till they're already collecting in January from 3 or 4 states. They're going to collect the big states, Texas, Arizona, and Georgia, in the latter part of that collection period. That's what they're talking about.
So they're not holding all of them for that five-month period to then
Correct.
Pull out? Okay.
That's just why I'd want to join later. So.
Okay, Georgia.
All right, then we will suggest we'll go with Georgia.
And that was
November.
They're going to push the whole thing back,
mm-hmm. And
which it deserves to be pushed back.
If we say November, that's when new applicants are required to take Part 1 and 2?
The new exam.
But then they'd still have a year to do both of, to complete both of those?
As we present it to them, we're going to encourage them to take them as quickly as they can.
One of the things we can do, which will help our licensees, our future licensees, is really encourage them to apply for the temporary license.
Yeah.
Because that then doesn't, you know, they can bill third-party payers and while they work through this exam. So I don't know. That I'm just trying to protect our future licensees.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I encourage all of my folks coming through our intern program get temporarily licensed to a postdoc.
It's actually not a bad financial deal, too. I was looking at the
numbers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We don't need any formal action on that?
No.
Okay. Let's go to agenda item 17. This is Ms. Heide. Can you tell us about an overview of the substantive policy statement addressing reproduction of public records and investigative records?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This request represents, it's a two-part ask. Number one, we are proposing that the policy statement provide a an opportunity for a respondent who is entitled by statute to a copy of their investigative record in lieu of charging them the 25 cents per page, which is stated in statute. We can reproduce the record electronically for a tiny fraction of that cost, a more reasonable cost. And so anyone who would like those records digitally, the fee would be $25. If they still wish to have hard paper copies, we would impose the 25 cents per page charge at that time. It just seems unreasonable to charge in some cases many hundreds of dollars when we can supply the digital file within minutes. So that's ask number one. The second is to authorize your executive director to, in an instance when someone requests the directory of licensees, rather than if the purpose of those records are non-commercial, meaning the requester isn't going to use them for any profit-based effort, then the executive director can waive the reproduction fee for those records. When I was with the Board of Physical Therapy, this was a fairly common practice. So just but to illustrate that distinction, if someone was requesting the directory for purposes of marketing a continuing education course, sure, we would charge that fee. If someone was requesting the directory just to reach out to former colleagues, former classmates, and they indicated as such on the form, then the executive director could, at his or her discretion, waive that fee. If you approve either one or both of these, it also represents, I think, a good faith demonstration that this board is taking a look at the fees that it's charging and looking for opportunities to reduce fees, unreasonable fees, in appropriate instances, which, of course, was one of the recommendations in your audit report.
What about research? If we called the office and wanted to send a survey to psychologists for the purposes of research?
That's a very appropriate, I think, instance where that could be included. It wasn't one that we had contemplated, but sure, it could be added.
Mm-hmm. I agree with what you're proposing. Mm-hmm. And I would make a motion we accept your proposal.
I second.
All in favor, aye.
I have a question regarding the respondent asking for records. Now, my understanding of the respondent asking for records of an investigation is that the respondent has the right to receive those records. So my concern would be that are we burdening the respondent and keeping those records behind a paywall by asking them to, pay for fees to obtain what is their right essentially to obtain.
This is Mark Harris, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm not familiar with the board's practice with respect to requests under 3206. I don't know that it's ever been an issue, and it seems like with this substantive policy statement, the concerns that that we would be creating a barrier would certainly be eliminated. And again, I don't know what the board's past practices were when it came to requests under 3206.
And if I may, I'm reading from the language in the statute, as Mark said, Mr. Harris said 3206. In subsection D, the board may charge the health professional or the health professional's attorney for the cost of providing the information received up to the fee for making a copy of each page as prescribed by section 12-284, subsection A. I'm not familiar with that particular statute, but the fee of $25 is certainly less than up to the fee of making a copy of each page.
Thank you.
So do we need a motion for your...
Yes, please.
I'll make the motion to approve.
I think there was a motion.
Oh, there was?
Yeah.
There's a motion and a second. We stopped the discussion. what I'm understanding is we used to have what's an antiquated procedure, but it's in the statute, that you charge
per page.
And what we're saying is in this day of electronics, instead of these multi-hundred dollar bills for duplicating, we send an electronic one.
And we save trees.
It seems to save time of staff time and copying, and it saves trees, it saves money, and it they're all good.
Do we have a motion and a second?
Yeah, we have a motion and a second.
All in favor, aye?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a related but not, you know, do we have all our records? They're all electronic records?
Not yet. No.
Okay. But, I mean, I know with licensing applicants, they are electronic in a sense because you send them to the board electronically.
Okay. Number 18, discussion, consideration, possible action. This matter is on the agendas. The board statutes requires an annual election of officers. And I will let the executive director take over at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, your statutes require annual election of officers, and I issued a request for the board members who were active on the roster at that time to indicate whether they would be willing to serve in a specific officer role. And so the response that we received was that Ms. Shreve expressed interest in serving specifically as board chair, and we also had interest expressed by both Dr. Flowers and Dr. Davis Wilson in the positions of chair and also vice chair, with a little bit of the qualifications that I've noted in the memorandum that, you know, some deference to other members' interests and skills, I suppose. So notably, we don't have any candidates for the office of secretary, so we will need nominations from the floor.
So how do we want to proceed with the applications? I noticed next to Dr. Davis Wilson, it says, if needed. So what is your preference, Dr. Davis?
Well, I'm happy to assist the board in whatever is necessary. So whether that is chair, vice chair, secretary, sitting back and doing nothing, I'm happy to assist in whatever is necessary and preferred by the board.
So I would run this. Okay. As we've done before, we have three candidates for board chair. I will go one by one. Right. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd like to remove my name.
Hey, Dr. Flowers has removed his name. I have two candidates for the office of chair, and we will vote by raising hands, as this has to be done publicly. All those who vote for Ms. Shreve, please raise your hand.
What about Mr. Dinar on the line?
Ask.
Mr. Dinar?
Well, yeah, that would be challenging, wouldn't it? I would abstain from number 18 at this point.
All right. Did we count?
I think it was unanimous.
It was unanimous. And those for Dr. Davis Wilson,
can
please.
We raise our hands again?
Well, I thought it was just going to create the conundrum. No. It looks like it was unanimous. Ms. Shreve will be the 2020 chairman of the board. We now are going to go to the position. Congratulations. Isn't this wonderful?
Congratulations, Ms. Shreve.
Who's laughing in the back? Dr. Brunder. All right. We now proceed to the election of vice chair. We have Dr. Flowers and Dr. Davis Wilson. We will yes, Dr. Flowers.
Yes, I think it'd be delightful if we had Dr. Diana Wilson do it.
Dr. Flowers has withdrawn, so I have the privilege of asking for election to vice chair of Dr. Davis Wilson by acclamation. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Dr. Davis Wilson is the vice chair for the board.
I nominate Dr. Flowers for secretary.
Dr. Flowers has been nominated for secretary. Are there any other nominations? And once, so any other nominations? Or twice, any other nominations?
Second.
Three times, hearing no other nominations, I move that Dr. Powers be elected secretary of the board by acclamation. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you. It's done. I moved us through elections.
Next is your turn. Let me do secretary, vice chair.
Okay.
All right. I'm moving to agenda item number 19. Oh, that's me. I did attend with Ms. Michelson the ASPPB annual membership meeting in Minneapolis. Was it 2 months ago?
Yes.
Some October. Such thing. And I think it was your first meeting there.
Yes, it was.
What did you think?
I thought it was a very eye-opening experience. What I really found helpful was the BARC meeting, which is the board administrators meeting. We met a day before, and there was approximately, I believe, 15 or 20 other jurisdictions there, including from Canada as well. So we all got to just talk about current issues in our states, things that were similar and different. So that was really enlightening, and it was nice to meet the other board administrators. So I was very appreciative of the opportunity.
Content of the meeting itself?
We talked about several things, particularly the enhanced ERPP. Some of the concerns that were discussed today were also discussed by some of the other board administrators, and the majority of them indicated that they wanted to wait on adopting the enhanced ERPP. One of the other things that was discussed is that in several states was the issue of appointments regarding board members. In Minnesota, apparently all of the healthcare boards there wrote a joint letter to the governor's office regarding their concern, and they found that to be very helpful in getting appointments.
Excellent. Anything from the main meeting itself?
Well, that would be number 20.
Okay, let's get that out of the way.
Okay. I am pleased to announce that Dr. Bohansky was appointed as a fellow by ASPPB. Established in 1990, the ASPPB fellows are selected by the board of directors to acknowledge outstanding contribution to ASPPB and to the field of psychology regulation. It is my understanding that Dr. Bohansky is currently the only fellow from the state of Arizona.
Woo-hoo.
While I attended the annual meeting in October, I had the privilege of witnessing Dr. Bohansky receive this award for his many accomplishments as a psychologist regulator. This occurred at the awards luncheon. The overwhelming support and enthusiasm for Dr. Bohansky receiving this achievement award was definitely felt in the audience. I do have a copy of the 2019 awards ceremony, which was also uploaded to the members' material. And I just want to end with basically saying that Dr. Bohansky is very deserving of this award. And since I've been here at this board, I am very much aware of your dedication, not only to this board, but to the field. So thank you, Dr. Bohansky, for everything that you've done.
Thank you very much. We needed to get past this. Okay, we're done. The last thing I'm going to say is that I'm inviting our new board members to the next. This will be the mid-year meeting of ASPPB, where they will do a new member board orientation. This will help meet the education requirements the state of Arizona has in terms of board members, and it will specifically give you an orientation as to the workings of the psychology boards across the country. I believe Dr. Meyer was the last one to go through it.
I was.
Found it helpful?
Absolutely.
So I'd look forward to and ask Ms. Shreve, your incoming chair, to see if we can send those folks to that training. I would also highly recommend, I know having extensive experience in working in the physical therapy version of ASPPB, our executive director, to begin integrating her knowledge and skill in with ASPPB, especially since one of our biggest issues is the one of competency, and that's one of her skills, having just gone through that with the physical therapy board. And I think that this issue of competency is incredibly important in all healthcare areas, I think we will see. Okay, so that takes care of 19-20-21 is a discussion, consideration, possible actions regarding correspondence received from Michael Morgan, PhD, as it relates to compliance with a request granted for extension of time to complete continuing education requirements. Ms. Poe, could you give us a quick update on that one?
Yes, Chairman and members of the board. On October 30th, 2019, the board office received correspondence from Dr. Morgan regarding a CE, continuing education, extension, which was granted, including documentation of his continuing education that he had completed and an admission that he had completed and was submitting the CE after the deadline, which was allowed by the board, which was August 31st, 2019. Board staff reviewed the CE documentation, and it appears that Dr. Morgan meets the CE requirements for his August 31st, 2018 license renewal, which pertains to, according to R426207, which pertains to continuing education. On December 5th, 2019, the board office received supplemental correspondence from Dr. Morgan, which lends additional information regarding the circumstances which prevented him from completing his CE on time. Dr. Morgan was unable to join the meeting today, but board staff is requesting direction from the board on how to proceed with this matter. All documentation has been provided for your review, and that concludes my summary.
Thank you. Discussion, concerns, questions? Dr. Farr.
I would like to have it approved, but I'm not sure what our options are administratively when somebody is gone past the due date of extension without notifying us. Is there any kind of guidance as far as our rules or statutes on that?
We've been rather flexible with it, is what I can suggest to you.
Can you make a motion? I make a motion that we accept his CEs and continue on.
I'll second that. Okay. Discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. That moves us to number 25. Discussion, consideration, possible actions on a request for clarification filed by Luis Sanchez pursuant to ARS 41-1001.02 relating to the board's interpretation of ARS 32-2071F as applied to the completion of an internship at two different sites. Ms. Heide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have much to add except to note that the statute affords you the authority or the ability to provide an interpretation when an inquiry is received, and the inquiry indicates that the statute is unclear. Board staff did review closely our statute and rule language against Mr. Sanchez's request. We could not arrive at a decision or a determination, and that's why it's before the board.
Questions?
So in essence, the two, she wants to do two internships at the same time? Is that what?
Do 6 months at one and then
and they go 6 months at the other.
Another.
And typically they do it all here at one place. Yeah. So the intent is really the internship. Do we care the location?
Well, and there were training issues.
Right, in the one place. That's what she was saying.
And so there was, it's, from what I could tell, it did not look like this was just the intern bailing on a site right. that might be more problematic, but rather training issues. They tried to address them in an appropriate manner. That hasn't happened, and so now looking to find a better opportunity.
I kind of gave her credit for trying to find a better internship.
Many internships do what they call rotations. And some of those rotations are through different portions of a program. For example, my internship, I have 28 full-time interns working for me. And we have 119 locations. So I have an intern who's 6 months in methadone or opioid dependence program, and then they rotate and do 6 months in a crisis stabilization unit. I don't know that that's much different than somebody doing two different locations. So I might suggest we consider it at a minimum 6 months is normally what a rotation is. That
it could be three, though. We've had this.
Well, and school systems do them a little bit differently, too. But it's not unusual for an intern to rotate or to have a couple placements.
So I'm not sure why it's even coming before us.
No.
We've seen multiple sites.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why is it coming before?
It seemed like he just wanted to make sure that this wasn't going to be a problem.
Right. Okay. Which is what we told him. Make sure you look at the statute and ask. So I think he's just confirming that this is a...
Please confirm with Mr. Sanchez that it's not a problem.
Well,
I think that we have to be careful. We as a board do not give advice.
Oh, that's right.
So we cannot really make a determination. I mean, they can talk to board staff and board staff can...
Well, no, I was just told we have the ability to make an opinion on something.
Yeah, this specific statute gives the board the authority to clarify for the applicant. And I think what I'm hearing is that we can simply... let the applicant know or the individual know that the applicable statute subsection F completing 2 6-month rotations would be allowed under the board's application of that statute. Right.
I just direct staff to do that, please.
Could we do that, Chairman? In the form?
Yeah.
I think, too, we need to indicate that both segments would need to
meet the requirements
of an internship.
Okay. Yeah, if we could have that in the form of a motion, Dr. Bohansky.
I move that we respond that two rotations of 6 months are appropriate, providing they meet the same standard supervision and patient contact and
interaction
with other intern requirements as
set forth in the statutes.
Yeah. Right.
I second the motion.
Thank you.
Motion and second. Questions? All in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Agenda item 26. Discussion, possible action regarding universal rec. I think we've already done that.
Yes.
We can
cross that one off. I think we've discussed 27 as well. My God.
Oh, you said 3 o'clock.
I didn't make it.
Close.
I apologize to the board. It is now 3:04, and I promised we'd be done at 3 o'clock. I am 240 seconds over time. Thank you, everybody. We've had a lot of helpful discussion. I think we've clarified some points. We've provided opportunities for more points to be clarified. I want to again welcome our new members, including our new executive director. I want to congratulate our new officers. our chairman and vice chairman. And quite frankly, I want to thank everybody for helping me get through a third term on this board. It's certainly been a pleasure, and I appreciate the support more than you could imagine. It's been very helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Bohansky.
Good job.
Fine leadership.
Saying that, are there any other agenda items that we want for future meetings? We've certainly listed a few and directed a few already. Hearing none, do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, staff.